From WXXI News, I'm Jasmine Singer, and this is Environmental Connections. Today's Environmental Connections began with a shocking discovery. A team of researchers in Switzerland recently revealed that 25% of the 14,000 chemicals used in food packaging have been found in our bodies, in our blood, our hair, even our breast milk. It was a startling reminder that microplastics aren't just an environmental issue anymore. They've become a direct threat to human health. These tiny particles, once thought to only pollute the air and the oceans, have now been found within our organs, from the brain to the liver. We're not just inhaling or consuming them. They're in our organs. They're everywhere. They're in our blood, in our brains. It's bananas. We're going to talk about that today. We're also going to talk about a recent article by Zoe Schlanger in The Atlantic, who discusses how avoiding microplastics has almost become a luxury, despite evidence showing that increased affluence and consumption often coincide with higher exposure to plastics. So with that growing body of research, it's no longer a question of whether microplastics are inside of us, but rather what they're doing to our bodies. And these findings raise urgent concerns about the impact of microplastics on our health and what actions we can take to mitigate the risks. So today we're diving into this urgent health crisis, and we're examining the impacts of microplastics, especially through our food packaging. We'll explore how these particles are infiltrating not just our environment, but our bodies, and what that means for our future. To help us navigate these complexities, I'm joined by an esteemed panel of experts. First, joining us remotely, we have Rick Smith, the executive producer of the new documentary Plastic People, now playing at the Little Theater. Rick has worked to protect people from the damaging impacts of pollution for over 20 years. He's also the president of the Canadian Climate Institute and the author of two books on toxic chemicals, including the international bestseller Slow Death by Rubber Duck, which the Washington Post described as hard-hitting in a way that turns your stomach and yet also instills hope. Rick, welcome. I hope you can instill some hope today.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Next in the studio, we have Dr. Jane Van Dis, an OBGYN at URMC. Dr. Van Dis's work on microplastics has captured the public's attention, especially through her recent viral TikTok video, which has something like more than 1.2 million views. It's probably more since I've written that. Jane's extensive work focuses on, among other things, the impact of plastics on pregnancy and children's health. And she's been a strong advocate for reducing plastic exposure. Jane, it's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us in the studio is Allison Elder, a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Environmental Medicine at the University of Rochester. Allison has dedicated her career to studying the toxins in the environment, including inhaled particles, which also includes ultrafine particle matter and nanomaterials, and more recently, those microplastics. Her work focuses on the health effects of these pollutants on the cardiovascular and central nervous systems. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really, really looking forward to talking to all of you. Lastly, we have Christy Tyler, a professor of environmental science at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Christy is an ecosystem ecologist who has worked across coastal, marine, and freshwater ecosystems on issues related to biogeochemistry, emerging contaminants and biodiversity and restoration. She currently serves as the co-director of the Center for Microplastics and Human Health in a Changing Environment. Christy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Rick, let's start with you. You've been at the forefront of documenting the effects of plastics on human health, and Plastic People has already begun making waves. Given the scope of your work, and there's a lot there, we could have you on for like 30 episodes in a row. What do you find most alarming about the effects of microplastics on human health?
Well, first of all, it's great to be here, and thanks for shining a light on this important topic.
You know, yes.
I guess what worries me most about this issue is that unfortunately, a lot of the things that we foreshadowed in the film are coming true. And so what we set out to do in the film, which was a few years in the making, it was released earlier this year. We finished filming last year. What we tried to do in the film is really focus not on the plastic in the environment, which is far more visible and obvious, and people get that, but to focus on these tiny invisible particles that increasingly scientists are telling us are taking up residence in human bodies, in your body and my body and our kids' bodies, and the human health impacts that are ensuing. And so some of what we showed in the film was the first time that these things were documented. So we, for instance, we spent some time with a research group in Turkey, who are the first folks in the world to find microplastic particles in a human brain. And unfortunately, there's been two subsequent studies from research groups elsewhere in the world corroborating that finding and actually deepening the concern related to microplastics in the human brain. So I wish that the film hadn't foreshadowed some of the problems that science is now underlining.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's really unfortunate. I'd rather you be able to predict things like lottery tickets than how we're going to all go down, apparently. Now, your documentary discusses the pervasiveness on plastics in everyday life, as you mentioned, especially in those items we wouldn't think twice about, like food containers and everyday packaging. So how is the plastic getting into our bodies? We don't eat the packaging.
Well, actually, we actually do eat portions of the packaging, unbeknownst to us. So, you know, the way that microplastics get into the body, and you have some other fantastic, you know, some of the literally the world leading researchers on your panel today on this topic. But plastics we are inhaled. We as we go about our daily lives, literally every second of the day, we're inhaling these tiny floating plastic particles. Microplastics are now the majority of house dust, because so many of the things we surround ourselves with every day are made out of plastic, including the clothing in our closets, our carpeting, our upholstery. An increasing percentage of all of these fibers are microplastics. So microplastics are generated not just from the stuff we throw away, but from the stuff that we surround ourselves with inside our homes and our offices and our cars every day. Microplastics are also ingested. So very clear that a lot of the plastics that the Christie's finding and other researchers are finding are the remnants of plastic packaging. And those packages wind up in the environment. They get degraded by the action of sunshine, by the pounding of waves, by the passing of time. And those big pieces of plastic, those macro plastics, pieces in your average disposable water bottle, over time gets pounded into tinier and tinier pieces that then become so light they become a permanent part of the ecosystem. So the reality of microplastics now is they surround us on a minute by minute basis.
Well, I have more questions for you, Rick, but hang tight while I check in with our other guests. Jane Van Dis, let's turn to you. Jane is an OBGYN and a passionate advocate for the climate. Jane, as I mentioned earlier, your recent viral TikTok video raised important concerns about microplastics being found in human brains and kidneys and livers, with a special focus on how heat, fat, and acidity accelerate plastic absorption into our bodies. Can you explain why having all this plastic inside us is so dangerous, particularly for pregnant women and children, but also for the rest of us?
Sure, Jasmine. I think that one thing that's helpful for the public to know is that actually, when I think about plastics, I divide them sort of into two categories. One is the actual particles themselves. And as Rick mentioned, those particles were found in the human brains. We've also seen studies where they're finding particles of plastic in the thrombi that patients who have a heart attack have, in the blood clots that people have in their legs, in the atherosclerotic plaques that they have in their carotid arteries. So that's, you know, more like the plastic becomes part of the architecture of the person's body. But that actually isn't the part of the plastic that I worry about the most. The part of the plastic that I worry about the most is actually the chemicals that are in the plastic. So we know, for instance, in that study that was published this week, showing that out of 13,000 chemicals in plastic food packaging, about 3,600 chemicals from that packaging make their way into the actual food. And of those, about 80 chemicals, the authors pointed out, were harmful. The types of chemicals that are in our plastic packaging are phthalates, PFAS, or the forever chemicals, bisphenol, parabens. There's entire classes of chemicals that are inside the plastics. And those chemicals actually are having, I think, some of the most deleterious impacts on our health. I came to this research actually because I was seeing so many more of my patients having hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. So chronic hypertension, gestational hypertension, preeclampsia. I noticed that my patients were getting sicker and sicker. And one of the reasons, I think, is that these EDCs, which is endocrine disrupting chemicals, these are the chemicals in the plastic, are causing injury to the placentas and to the vasculature of my patients, therefore leading them to have more hypertensive diseases in pregnancy. So what we know is that these chemicals cause oxidative injury, they cause inflammation, and we've seen a lot of chronic diseases whose backbone is inflammation on the rise. They cause immune responses, damage to DNA, cardiogenicity, meaning, or carcinogenicity, meaning increased risk for cancer, and reprotoxicity. So we do think that some of these chemicals are responsible for increasing infertility rates, not only in women, but also in men. So you can see from what I've listed, there's kind of a whole array by which these chemicals are harming our blood vessels, our organs, and I'm mostly interested to the next generation.
Well, that's terrifying, Dr. You don't come here to cheer us up.
I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. And I know you're in the middle of a shift right now. We're so grateful for this information because we have to have it. I mean, this, I feel like this is just emerging in a more mainstream way. I think that the viral nature of your video kind of proves that. Dr. Van Dis, given the overwhelming presence of plastics in everyday life, what are some misconceptions you've encountered in your work about whether they're harmful and how to reduce exposure to the microplastics?
Well, I do think that the public might not know. I've had over 10,000 comments on the viral video that you spoke of. And what I find is that a lot of people are shocked. People are shocked to know that actually when they have a soda in an aluminum can, that it's actually lined with plastic. If you melt off the aluminum with hydrosulfuric acid, what you'll find is a plastic liner. So the difference between an aluminum can and a plastic bottle is actually, they're both made of plastic. And in fact, the aluminum, since it conducts heat more effectively than plastic, actually might get hotter. And therefore, more of the plastics in an aluminum can leaching into the beverage versus a plastic bottle. I will say it was interesting on my video or on my viral video is that I had not one, but many people tell me that they work in distribution warehouses where they see our food, beverages, on pallets in the sun baking. And this, this type of action actually, as you pointed out earlier, causes the plastics to leach into the food or the beverage faster. So I do think the public imagines that plastic in itself is inert, and I think they've been told that. So I do think that there's kind of an eye-opening that's happening across the country, thank goodness, as we see these studies come out.
Well, I grew up in those fluorescent 1980s where microwavable TV dinners were all the rage. And, we just ate them out of the plastic container.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it's definitely in me, but my guess is it's in all of us, right?
Oh, absolutely. What's been interesting, looking at, for instance, PFAS, which is a forever chemical that is in a lot of the packaging, is that when scientists want to study the effects of PFAS on the body, they can't find a control, meaning they can't find a human who doesn't have it in them in order to compare and contrast. I think that the studies are showing that our placentas are full of plastic. Our babies' first you know, poops are full of plastic. So it's rather, where are we going to go from here, given that we know now that these chemicals and plastic particles are inside?
That's Jane Van Dis, OBGYN, specializing in microplastics and maternal and fetal health. Let's turn to Allison. Allison Elder is a postdoctorate fellow at the Department of Environmental Medicine at the U of R. Allison, could you tell us about where airborne microplastics come from and how you see them affecting human health?
So I've been studying the toxicology related to inhaled particles for a long time, including my postdoctoral training, which was actually a long time ago.
So, oh, really? Yes. Do I have an outdated bio for it?
I'm an associate professor at the University of Rochester
okay,
Medical
thank
Center.
You.
That's so fine. So most of the work that I have focused on has been related to the really tiny particles that we breathe in workplace and ambient air. So the so-called ultrafine or nanoparticles. We know that particles that are airborne at that size range deposit everywhere in the respiratory tract with pretty high efficiency, and they don't stay there. Really tiny particles can get out of the lung and be distributed via the lymphatics or the bloodstream to distal tissues, including the brain and the placenta and every other organ system. Mm-hmm. That makes up a tiny fraction of what deposits in the lung that gets out of the lung, but that's from a single exposure. And this is pretty well-established work that's been done quite rigorously by scientists around the world. But what we know from that is that the efficiency of translocation is inversely proportional to particle size. So that means that it's the tiniest particles, so nanoscale particles, that are getting out into the bloodstream. So it's kind of surprising to me to find these huge microplastic particles in tissues. And so I think that's one of the first things that needs to be rigorously tested and understood, is to understand how to investigate this, is to understand how those particles are moving around the body, because it seems to go against what we thought we knew about where particles go. Mm. But it's not surprising to me that we find particles in tissues just in general, because we've known for a long time that particles that accumulate in tissues, unless they're going to dissolve in our tissues, which can happen, they're likely to just stay there, because we have to wait. Our tissues have to wait until the garbage cleaners of our organ systems decide to take care of these things and either move them out of the body or dissolve them, the so-called macrophages. Mm. So that takes a long time. So we don't know, though, when it comes to microplastics, how the tissues are acting on the particles. We also don't know very much about how the particles are acting on the tissues. It's that the findings that have been published in the literature, and I want to make sure that this is emphasized, is that's the beginning of the story, not the end of it. We have a ton of work that needs to be done to understand the size ranges of polymeric particles that confer deleterious health effects. We don't know the composition, if there are compositional signatures that are related to adverse outcomes. We don't know very much about how these particles can deliver the PFAS and the bisphenols into the tissues. There are so many questions that we need to address, and you know, that's kind of what gets basic scientists like me interested in a field like this.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine. Did you also grow up in the 80s eating those microwavable meals?
I recall eating a few of them,
yes. Or in the Tupperware, over and over again, probably not so good for us. So there's a lot we don't know, but do you know if there are certain health conditions that make people more vulnerable to exposure?
Yes, that's something that's been fairly well documented in the literature when it comes to inhaled particles. So, you know, when I was in graduate school, which was a while ago, The evidence that inhaled particles could have independent health effects in humans was still being debated. Now we know that there are different size classes that have differential toxicity and related health effects. But we know that there are, what we think we know from years of research, is the different mechanisms by which these particles can confer toxicity. So yes, translocation to an organ system is one of those mechanisms. retention in lung tissue or other tissues that can cause an inflammatory and oxidative stress reaction over a long period of time can cause adverse health outcomes. And so people who have existing conditions that make already have their tissues at a level of inflammatory response or pro-oxidative responses can be more susceptible or vulnerable to
like what
so like people who have cardiovascular disease, so people who have COPD. So those are things that might confer susceptibility. But then we also have to think about vulnerability. So, you know, we can all be susceptible to something, but when we're little teeny babies or developing babies, we are vulnerable because there's nothing we can do when we're a developing fetus mm-hmm. about what our mother takes in. And likewise, if we're really if we're old and going into senescence, it makes us more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So yes, disease state and vulnerabilities can make us sicker when we inhale particles.
All right. Well, I have many more questions about that. That is Allison Elder. Let's turn to Christy Tyler, the professor of environmental science at RIT. Christy, while our focus today is on human health, you've done significant work on how plastic pollution impacts ecosystems. What happens when these microplastics make their way from the environment into our food supply? And how does it tie back into the larger human health crisis that we're facing?
So I think first it's important to kind of think about how the plastic gets there in the first place. And you mentioned when you were describing these bigger macroplastics breaking down into microplastic that it's these big items, wrappers or cigarette butts that end up in the environment. They're all of these different kinds of plastic. And as Jane mentioned, they have lots of different kinds of chemicals embedded in them. So the plastic then breaks down in the environment into little tiny pieces by waves and wind and sunlight and microbes. We're discovering more and more microbes that can break down plastic. And as the particles get smaller and smaller, they become covered with microbes. Some of these are pathogens, mm-hmm. Known pathogens, and the plastic actually seems to harbor more pathogens than something like a piece of sand. And they also can harbor bacteria that are antibiotic resistant. Mm-hmm. But in the environment, you know, someplace like Lake Ontario, where we have a lot of these legacy contaminants, things like PCBs and dioxins, the plastics also absorb those chemicals. So we have plastic in the environment that is not the same as it was when it entered as a candy wrapper. It has very different properties. And so that makes the problem even more complex when we think about how they're getting back into our food, into our drinking water, into the particles that we breathe, because it's not a pristine particle that was manufactured by a chemical plant. It's been acted on by the environment, so it changes.
Mm. Well, I know you're also the co-director of the Center for Microplastics and Human Health in a Changing Environment. Can you explain how your work on freshwater ecosystems relates to the human health consequences we've been discussing?
Sure. I think that one of the things we're hoping to do with this new center, which I could give a real quick background on that this is a collaborative center that's funded jointly by the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation through their Centers for Oceans and Human Health program. And these centers, there's six across the country, have the focus of combining people who study the environment with people who study human health in a very intentional way and encouraging that collaborative discussion. Often scientists tend to work in their little silos, and this program is specifically designed to bridge those silos. And so our work on the environmental aspects of plastic pollution, some of it is on input. So understanding what are the most common plastics in the environment and where do they go and what happens to them is critical to understanding people's exposure to those plastics, because we need to know what they are that are coming into the environment. So we are also doing experiments where we'll be aging plastics intentionally in the environment and then providing them to scientists at the University of Rochester who will do experiments to understand the toxicological effects on human systems. So it's an important collaboration to get people who come at the problem from really different angles to talk to each other.
That's Dr. Christy Tyler, who is a professor of environmental science at RIT. If you're listening to this conversation about microplastics and you are horrified, or perhaps you have insight or you have questions, we would love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. If you're local, you can call 585-263-9994. I'm going to ask one more question to Rick, and then we'll take a short break. Rick, you've written extensively on toxic chemicals and their impact on human health. In your opinion, especially after hearing all of this information from our in-studio guests today, are we seeing enough global action from governments or corporations to tackle this plastic crisis, or is the response still falling far short?
I'm actually really encouraged that just in the last couple of years, we're starting to see the response from governments, from big companies in response to consumer action. That response is really the kicking up a notch. And so most, you know, as one example of this, the countries of the world are busily working, are actually headed towards the final round of negotiations of a new full-blown global treaty on plastic pollution. So a very exciting initiative, lots of support for this from countries in both the global north and the global south. The United States has recently changed its position to be far more supportive of a strong global treaty. And if all goes well, within a few months, we're going to have a new climate change treaty style resetting of the rules for plastic production, use, and disposal globally. And you know, some of the things on the table are getting rid of, banning the most dangerous types of plastic. I mean, it's very clear now that certain types of plastic are more carcinogenic than others. So just bonkers that we're continuing to use these things, allowing the use of these things on a daily basis. Recycling systems around the world, largely ineffective in dealing with the plastic, the mountain of plastic that's being produced every day that needs reforming. Of course, about 40% of plastics used are single-use items. So lots of ways that we can reduce the use of plastic across the board. I think we're on the verge of a new approach to this issue.
Good. We need that. That's Rick Smith, the executive producer of Plastic People. And I just want to shout out one more time that there is another showing of Plastic People tomorrow at the Little Theater. So if you're listening to this, I sincerely hope you can make it to that. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll hear from those of you who are calling in, as well as some follow-up questions to our guests who are talking today about microplastics. We'll be right back. I'm Jasmine Singer. Coming up in our second hour of Environmental Connections, we'll be diving into the world of climate activism and the arrests that come with it, from New York City to Rochester and far beyond. We'll hear from activists and legal experts about how these protests are pushing for environmental change. It's all coming up next on Environmental Connections. I'm Jasmine Singer, and you're listening to Environmental Connections. Environmental Connections is on the air here on WXXI the last Friday of the month. Today, we're talking about microplastics, which is finally starting to get the attention that it needs, though, as our researchers here today are telling us, there's still a whole lot more that we need to learn. If you have any questions for our guests, be sure to call in 844-295-8255. If you're local, 585-263-9994. Allison, I want to turn to you. With the growing focus on plastic contamination in the human body, in addition to just getting rid of all this plastic, are there specific policy changes you think might help mitigate these health risks?
Well, I was really encouraged to hear what Rick just said about a global approach to addressing the pollution problem, because if you minimize exposure, then theoretically there shouldn't be a health risk. I want to point out that hazard and risk are not the same things, though. So we usually think about putting the puzzle pieces together in such a way that we understand the inherent toxicity of a material and have a full understanding of exposure, and not just external exposure, but how that hazardous material gets into the body and is retained in tissues and excreted and metabolized, etc. So putting those puzzle pieces together is how we derive risk. And the approaches that Rick was talking about are great because they're addressing the exposure side of things. I think that in order to have a durable policy change, we have to understand the full risk picture, which involves, like I said, putting those two pieces of the puzzle together about exposure and hazard.
There are a lot of pieces that we need to put together. And Christy, you are putting some of those pieces together on a somewhat different level. You've mentioned that environmental research on microplastics is somewhat ahead of the research on human health. We're now in the phase of discovering microplastics everywhere we look, but we're still largely uncertain about the health impacts, which, you know, is really hard for me to wrap my head around. Can you share how your environmental research may help us understand the potential harm that microplastics pose to human health?
So I think we could maybe frame that in the setup that Allison had on what are the most common products that are out there, are the common microplastics, and then which ones pose the greatest toxicity, because that puts it in a framework of where are we most likely to be exposed, and then how bad is it? And so in environmental systems or in, say, aquatic organisms, we've been able to do experiments, which are not as easy to do on people. Mm-hmm. You can use model systems. You can use different organisms that maybe their immune systems, for example. We have a scientist on our team with the Microplastic Center that uses frogs as a model system to be able to understand those effects. But in aquatic ecosystems, we've been able to evaluate what are the most common particles that we're seeing and then use those experimentally to understand the risk. And we're able to also be able to separate some of the complicated issues associated with, and this is what Jane brought up, having a particle present and then having a particle that has all the chemicals associated with it. So you can do experiments where you separate those two factors and figure out, is it just the chemicals that are associated with this, or is it the fact that there's a particle present, or is it both? Because they have different impacts on cells, on immune responses, as an endocrine disruptor. And so we've been able to do those on other organisms, particularly in aquatic ecosystems, which is where there's a lot of microplastics.
Well, and sticking with the idea of what's in animals' bodies for just a moment, I would assume that these plastics are not just in our bodies, but in the bodies of everyone who lives on Earth, including the animals, mammals, birds, insects. How much do we know about who has plastic inside them in the non-human world and what it might be doing to them? Not the animals who are being tested on, but the animals in the wild.
So I think that is beginning to go into the same phase of where we were with plastic in the environment itself, where it's not surprising to find it anymore. There are studies of, you know, fish in the Great Lakes. Almost all of them have microplastics in their gut. Now that we're developing techniques to find smaller and smaller microplastics, we find them in their gills and we find them in their flesh, the fillet. They're in mussels and oysters and a lot of the food that we eat. There also are newer studies showing that plants can take up microplastics. So plants grown in fields that have been cultured in a plastic culture, where we use plastic to keep down weed growth and help with irrigation, those little plastic particles are now small enough that the plants can take them up. And that's a whole newer realm of research that we hadn't really been thinking about before, is that plants can actually accumulate plastic.
Oh, wow. Okay. But yeah, that's a whole other that's a whole other show, I suppose. Although, I mean, we could talk about that for hours as well. I feel like we're just touching on some of these issues. I see we have some callers, but I want to ask Jane one question first. Jane, is it easier to get people to pay attention to the idea that plastics are actually in their bodies rather than in the external environment? Because it's directly affecting them?
Well, I do feel that our studies right now aren't currently where we can say, you know, absolutely, when you heat your Tupperware in plastic and then you get a diagnosis of endometriosis, that it was because you were heating your food in your plastic container in the microwave. So we're not there where we can say there's direct causality. What we can say is that, you know, for instance, the studies that came out about the plastics in the brain, it turns out that of those people who had higher percentage of plastics in their brain also had higher percentage of dementia and Alzheimer's. So again, we're making inferences, but we're not able to say direct causation. And I know that that's frustrating for us as healthcare providers, and I'm sure it's frustrating for listeners as well. Having said that, I do think that we can take some precautionary measures to try and limit our exposures. And so I hope that, you know, I hope that listeners today can take away what some of those key ways to mitigate the exposure to plastics.
Well, let's go to our listeners. We have Dennis, you are on the line. Dennis from Pittsburgh is a retired professor of plastic science. And I think, Jane, you might be able to shed light on what Dennis has called about. Dennis, welcome to Environmental Connections.
Well, thank you. I taught the subject for 37 years, and of course, this included both the synthesis as well as the degradation and stabilization of plastics. And I'm alarmed by the microplastics in the environment. My daughter is an epidemiologist, and her doctoral work at Johns Hopkins showed that babies, these are newborns, after 4 days, only 4 days and 10 days, 90% of them had bisphenol A metabolites in their urine. So some of these babies, many of them, were just nursed. The only source of anything ingested was the mother's milk. And others, you know, were bottle fed, but it's been shown that there is no bisphenol A in infant formula. So at the time, I remember asking my daughter, this was maybe 10 or 12 years ago, where does it come from? You know, and we kind of kicked around some ideas, and we really didn't know. And it seems to me now that microplastics are a likely culprit, inhaled, you know, just everywhere. But the alarming thing was infants, newborns, have these chemicals in their body. And fortunately, they were able to metabolize them, but still, you know, the exposure is there.
Jane, do you have any insight into what Dennis is talking about here?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when these studies about the brain came out, people were like, but what about the blood-brain barrier? And the fact is that when the chemicals get small, or when the particles get small enough, they can cross that blood-brain barrier. In fact, there was an interesting study 2 weeks ago showing that they found a bunch of microplastics in the olfactory bulb, which is the organ that sits right at the top of our nose, allows us to smell. So the microplastics in the bulb obviously could also then be migrating into the brain. And so if we know that plastic particles can cross a really, really tight membrane like the blood-brain barrier, they absolutely are crossing the placenta, which is a more porous, you know, larger sizes of particles can cross the placenta. So I would say, you know, to answer caller's question, absolutely, probably these are maternal exposures that are then being passed on to the fetus. And I will say, you know, something fascinating to think about, and I hope I'm not going too far off track here, Jasmine, but, you know, what's happening is that we're actually poisoning not the current generation that's gestating inside the mother, but then her children as well, because these chemicals make it into the oocytes, the eggs inside her fetus, if it's a girl, inside her womb. And so then the expression of those chemicals continues on into two generations down the line. So
wow.
we really need to work, as Rick pointed out, on this global plastics treaty as fast as we can, because the amount of plastics in the environment is only increasing and the health burdens are increasing as well.
I think when people hear about this, they want to get involved. They want to make sure that that's not happening. Our caller right now is Vinod from Rochester, who has a question along that line. Vinod, welcome to Environmental Connections.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, my name is Vinod.
Vinod, sorry about
that. I'm a graduate from RIT and very much interested in environmental. And I have a question for Christy. How a general public, or how can I be a part of the research, please?
That's a great question.
So that's a great question. And I will say that one of the pieces of the center, and it's not a part of necessarily looking at microplastics, but it's part of our research looking at input of plastic to the environment, has a community science component. And we are encouraging people to join us in taking inventories of the plastics that we're finding in the environment. So you can find my email online and reach out to me, and we can make sure that you're aware of some of the events that we're working on.
We have a question from a caller off the air. Bob in Rochester says, is there any progress on getting rid of the plastic island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean? And then asks, wasn't there a teen that had developed a process for things like that? Who wants to take that? Rick?
Yeah, I'm happy to weigh in. It's interesting that I think because a lot of this plastic research started in the oceans, there's still this notion that plastic pollution is worse in the oceans. And of course, I don't want to diminish the significance of that Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and that there is actually some progress in cleaning that up. But you know, a lot of the recent science has started looking for plastic in places we haven't looked before. So, you know, really inaccessible terrestrial ecosystems, the highest mountains, the deepest ocean trenches. And the reality of microplastics is that plastic pollution is literally everywhere that scientists are looking. So we, you know, what started as a realization or a suspicion that plastic pollution was bad in the oceans, and there's this very obvious Great Pacific Garbage Patch, has turned into a more worrisome realization that plastic pollution is very widespread. And of course, that's the reason that it's now being absorbed into human bodies, because it's indoors, it's outdoors, it's on the land, it's on the ocean, it's in the ocean, it's everywhere. And it's that ubiquity that's a big part of the problem.
Something occurs to me when I hear you talking about that, Rick, which is, you know, I've heard that question from others as well about the big plastic island. And I wonder if there's something in our human nature that's almost like soothed or reassured by the fact that whatever the problem is happening over there, not here.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Oh, I think that's right. And in fact, we wrestled with this in the filming of our film, Plastic People. And if I can make a shameless plug here, Jasmine.
Please.
Folks can find the movie online, plasticpeopledoc.com, plasticpeopledoc.com. We put a bunch of resources online, links to incredible groups right around the world that are wrestling with this problem, making progress. You know, solutions are possible, so people should check out that website. But we had a couple of problems in the making of the movie, right? We basically set out to make a movie about tiny invisible particles that are impossible to film, and we had to figure out a way to convey the story in an impactful but a hopeful way, because we didn't want to leave people, you know, terribly depressed and feeling like, you know, we're all doomed and there's no point. And so what we did in the film is we actually spent time with great research groups around the world, including Christie's at RIT. And the protagonist in our movie, the great science journalist, Xia Tong, she actually subjected her own body to testing. We tested her blood. We tested her gut. We tested basically tested her life for microplastics. To do what you've mentioned, Jasmine, to really try to bring, literally to try to bring the story home. It's not over there. This is not a problem, you know, happening in a few rivers in Southeast Asia. This is not a problem that only exists in the global south. This is the most global challenge imaginable, and it demands global solutions. And it exists, you know, the problem manifests in your living room, in your kitchen, and in your kid's body.
Yeah, this is ringing so many bells for me because of, you know, my work over the last couple of decades on animal rights. And it just feels so similar that there's just this inclination to kind of point to somewhere else that's not here and how this is impacting other communities, but not mine. And as the film Plastic People showed, without a shadow of a doubt, this is urgent. This is an emergency. And I'm grateful for the guests today. You're all approaching this topic from different perspectives. Before we wrap up, in our time we have left, I'd like to check in with all of you about that path forward. And Rick, we'll start with you. What should the average person be doing to reduce their personal exposure to microplastics? And more broadly speaking, how can we collectively address this issue on a societal level?
So a good resource is people can start with the website for the movie, plasticpeopledoc.com, and regardless of where they live in the U.S., regardless of where they live in the world, they can find a list of suggestions for a path forward. And I sometimes suggest that people think in terms of what they can do as consumers. And, you know, we have power as a consumer. I mean, of course, we can't just spend our way out of this mess we've created for ourselves. But if you have a choice in the grocery store between buying a product in a plastic package versus something in a glass package, you should go with the glass. I mean, so whatever you can do to start looking at labels, take a look at the labels of the clothing you're thinking of buying, the new couch you're thinking of buying, to the extent that you can reduce the amount of plastic you're schlepping into your house, you should do that and reward those companies that are trying to use non-plastic alternatives. Mm. But then, you know, ultimately we need to, I mean, as you say, we need to act together as citizens. We need to demand that our governments are supporting better regulation. This is, you know, the path forward here is not rocket science. We got to make sure that the plastics we use are less harmful. And we need to use less of them. You know, there's lots of examples, communities across the U.S. that are doing better on this issue now. And we just need to accelerate those solutions.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Jane. Turning to you, I'm wondering if patients want to get more information about plastics and endocrine disruptors and PFAS, and maybe not even just patients, but hopefully not to become patients, where should they turn?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I have to advertise. I'm going to do a self-plug too, Rick.
And, do it.
And say, you know, they should tune into my TikTok because that's all I talk about on my channel. And I'm at jvandis, V-A-N-D-I-S. There are other influencers out there who have great channels as well. And I will say I also started OBGYNs for Sustainable Future, which is an interest group of healthcare without harm. This is an international body of healthcare providers, nurses, doctors, and people working, serving patients, recognizing that actually healthcare produces more plastic waste than any other industry. So we do have an edict to first do no harm. And there are studies showing that, you know, NICU babies with all of the tubing that they have actually are receiving not only the particles, but the chemicals inside the plastic. So here you have a baby that, as Chrissy said, or Allison said, is vulnerable. And, you know, and then we're filling them with some of these chemicals. Mm-hmm. And
I want to say something else too, Jasmine, and that is that, you know, when I think about this problem, I get angry, and I'm not sure if some of you out there listening are angry too. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, although this is a new subject for WXI to look at, the people who made these chemicals actually knew about their harm, and they knew about their harm a long, long, long time ago. There's been some great reporting out by ProPublica about how long scientists have known about the harms of PFAS, of phthalates, of the phenols. I want to say if you see something that's BPA-free, it might not have BPA in it, but it might have BPS or F. So there's this thing where they substitute a different sounding chemical or a chemical with a different name. It still has the same effect on the body. So I'm not trusting these chemicals to protect our health. Importantly, Jasmine, 10 to 12% of all global oil goes into plastics manufacturing. Right now, the plastics industry is about $624 billion industry, and it's expected to grow up to about $850 by 2030. So unless we stop buying these things, unless we start demanding better, and we also need to vote for representatives who care about our health, we will continue to see that market grow. And I love this idea of the Global Plastics Treaty. You know, one of the things that was important was that healthcare be included in the Global Plastics Treaty. And for a while, healthcare was like, oh, we're staying out of it. But in fact, we as healthcare are actually doing harm.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Allison and Christy, 10 seconds or less. Any final thoughts here about the future of microplastics research or anything about you want to share?
I would just urge people to make sure that what we're replacing plastics with, using the example of BPA, is actually not more harmful.
Yes. And thank you so much. Do you have anything to add very quickly?
I think it's just get involved and be informed. Thank you. There's many opportunities.
Thank you so much to my panel, Rick Smith, executive producer of Plastic People, Dr. Jane Van Dis, Allison Elder, and Christy Tyler. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Jasmine Singer. Until next time, thanks for making today's Environmental Connections.